Femi Oke, welcome to the stream. The last time man went to the moon was in 1972, and it looks like we're about to do it again. Why is one question. We have an expert panel of guests who will tell you why, what it means, how much it might cost. I know you've got a ton more questions. Please do share them with us as we look at, is it time for mankind to go back to the moon? Hello, Rick. Hello, Robin. Hello, Joey. It's so good to have you all on the show today. I said you were experts, and I want you to prove how expert you are. So, Rick, say hello to our audience around the world. Tell them who you are and what you do.
Sure. Hello, everyone. I'm Rick Henfling. I'm a NASA flight director, and I am involved in the real-time execution of the Artemis 1 mission from Houston, Texas.
Good to have you. Hello, Robin. Welcome to the stream. Introduce yourself to our audience around the world. Tell them your connection to the moon.
Sure. I look at the moon every day. My name is Robin C. Mangle. I'm a spaceflight journalist covering the Artemis program for the last 8 years. And I'm just a general fan of the moon and the solar system.
Oh, I love that you're on this show. Hello, Joey. Welcome to the stream. Tell everybody who you are, what you do, your connection to the moon, please.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here. I'm Joey Roulette. I'm a space reporter for Reuters covering NASA and talking to experts like Rick.
Very good. I want to take you gents back to last Wednesday when this happened. Rick, take a look. I want to hear how it felt to be right there.
Four-stage engine start. 3, 2, 1. Boosters in. And liftoff of Artemis 1. We rise together back to the moon and beyond.
Rick, what was it like?
Oh, it was tremendous. I had the second best seat in the house. Uh-huh. Obviously, the best seat in the house would have been from the coast of Florida to watch it live.
Sure.
But the second best seat was certainly in mission control. There was a buzz in the air, and the team was just couldn't be more happy to finally get this mission off the ground. And I have to say, it's been going beyond anyone's expectations.
Rick, I'm
we had a tremendously important day this morning.
Yeah.
We made our closest pass by the moon at an altitude of about 130 kilometers. And we are setting up to get into orbit around the moon here, and we'll get into that orbit on Friday.
We are just going to show, because I was watching this morning, the close pass past the moon. It happens very slowly. So I was watching, then walked away, then came back, and then I could see more movement happening. Rick, can you explain to our audience what we're seeing right now? What happened earlier today?
So I can't, I don't see the video that you're showing, but what happened earlier today is Orion slowed down as it approached the moon, and we executed a firing of our main engine to, it was the first of two engine firings that are going to put us into an orbit around the moon. The orbit is about 70,000 kilometers above the surface. And we did this firing of the engine without communication with the spacecraft. So it was incumbent on the teams of flight controllers on the ground to get the Orion vehicle configured. And we set it up and put everything on a timer. And on the backside of the moon, when we can't have a line of sight to the vehicle,
yeah.
the Orion spacecraft executed that burn. And it was flawless, and we couldn't be happier.
So Robin, I can hear from Rick's voice that he's having a really good time at work right now. Like, the best time at work.
He has the best job in the
right.
world.
He's loving every moment. You can hear the excitement in his voice. There are going to be a lot of people in the world saying, why are we doing this again? Didn't we do this in the 70s?
Right. And the space fan in me says, why not? I think that we're a civilization that has these capabilities and the brain power to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think that we might have paused a little bit on our deep space ambitions. I think after 1972, we tried to build a little bit of an economy and a infrastructure in orbit with the space shuttle and the space station. And I think that's been very successful. The space station has helped us learn about living in deep space. We had our year in space experiment. We grow veggies on the space station. We see what international cooperation is like in space aboard the space station. That's something that's really important when we're thinking about living on the moon, and we're going to have Chinese neighbors, Russian neighbors, Italian neighbors, French neighbors. I think that the space station was a diversion from our deep space efforts, but it was a really important one. Mm. And I think that now that we've, you know, I think we feel accomplished on the space station. I think it's time for NASA to move forward with getting humans back on the moon permanently, and then, you know, going further to Mars, which I think is what is on everyone's mind, especially in the space industry.
I'm just thinking the last time that there was a lunar program was in the 1970s. So that was Apollo. Now we've got right. Artemis. Joey, what is the difference between Apollo and Artemis?
Yeah, well, I think Robin made a great point, is that, you know, we did focus a lot on low Earth orbit for a while, and we learned a lot from that. And yeah, a lot of people have asked, why are we going back to the moon now, so long after Apollo? And I think what separates the two is that, you know, NASA really wants, with Artemis, to turn this kind of moon program into something that's sustainable and use the moon as kind of a launching pad to future missions to Mars. And that's different from the Apollo program because that program was mainly kind of spurred by, you know, geopolitical competition and proving what the U.S. can do in space. And we put boots on the moon a number of times, and we didn't go back after that. But, you know, the difference here is that, you know, NASA has had this space station in low Earth orbit. They're trying to hand that over to private companies in the next decade. And they're going to put what they hope to be, you know, kind of like a space on the surface of the moon. It's just kind of extending the reach in space. It's another step forward.
Rick,
International Space Station was tremendous as it relates to learning how to cooperate with multiple nations in low Earth orbit. And I am really hopeful that as we move out to the moon and beyond, we're going to be able to continue those collaborations and really show what the multi-nation efforts can accomplish when we work together as opposed to as competitors.
I really like that idea of the cooperation part of it, because I kind of remember in the 1970s, it was more like a space race. It's like, who could get there first and what are they doing when they get there? But now it's a whole load of not just governments, but also private companies as well. If you were going to tell us the main players, some of them we know about Virgin Galactic. We know about Elon Musk. Who else do we know, and how are they contributing?
Jeff Bezos, I think, is the one of the important ones we need to mention within that.
With Blue Origin, yeah,
with Blue Origin, I think that the space race is, as it stands right now, is between the public sector and the private sector, sure. And I think that we are starting to see cooperation. I think Artemis is a great example. SpaceX is developing a deep space vehicle, Starship. NASA has been developing SLS. They're going to work in concert to bring humans to the moon. I think that really is a big case study for what will happen in deep space. I think we'll have private entities building technology, and it will have government entities like NASA paying them for their services. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of Artemis and the relationship between the public and the private sector. And, you know, speaking of the leaders, SpaceX, I think that's going to trickle down to other companies. I think Rocket Lab has solar panels on Artemis, and that shows you that every company can have an input, and it could be a great relationship and one that makes it economically sustainable for the taxpayer.
Joey?
Yeah, I think I just want to say, I think case study is like the right way to put it. And, you know, NASA is learning a lot about how it works with these private companies. They're, you know, the agency's leaning a lot on their expertise, and in turn, they're relying a lot on NASA's funds to get there. And it's just kind of this new partnership model that they proved successfully in the Commercial Crew program, where SpaceX and Boeing built capsules to go to and from the ISS. But, you know, there's a lot to be seen on how, you know, lunar operations is going to work. And, you know, NASA did have a good kind of trial run and good experiences on the ISS with international partnerships with other countries. But there's a lot of new questions that they're going to have to confront going on the moon, with, you know, international cooperation, laws, and how companies are going to behave on the moon. And I think, you know, it's just going to be really interesting to see how that kind of
takes. So much to talk about. SLS Orion is the NASA rocket. So that belongs to NASA. Artemis is the mission. So if you remember, like, the Apollo missions, Apollo 1, Apollo 2, Apollo 3, we're going to have Artemis 1, Artemis 2, Artemis 3. So that's the mission, not the actual space hardware. Earlier, Bob Cabana was talking about cooperation. He was quite excited about it. It's not China against Russia or Russia against the US or private companies versus NASA. It's everybody working together. This is what Bob said about a week ago.
It is a truly cooperative effort, and much of what the private money that's going into space, you know, it's enabling what NASA does. We are utilizing that. We want to establish a commercial economy in low Earth orbit so that we can focus on that hard job of exploring beyond our home planet.
I'm just looking, Rick, at the NASA team. And look at this diversity. I mean, in the 70s, it was a load of blokes. And now look at all the people who are going to either live on the moon or be part of the Artemis mission. This is amazing, isn't it?
And that's just the team of NASA astronauts. We have agreements set up with the Canadian Space Agency, with the European Space Agency, and with the Japanese Exploration Agency as well. So it's not going to be just NASA astronauts participating in these Artemis crewed landing missions. We're going to have international astronauts involved in all of the missions in the future.
And we're going to have private astronauts too, I think.
Really?
Yes, I think that once that SpaceX can prove that their vehicle can go to the moon and back, they will start selling tickets. They've already sold tickets to two customers for Starship lunar orbit missions. And I think that as soon as they land that Starship on the moon and bring it back home, I think you're going to start seeing
spinning that
up. Yeah, I think they're going to spin up those kinds of operations. I think it's a natural step. SpaceX has always said that they want to put humans on Mars.
But is this frivolous, though? I'm just thinking, Joe, is this frivolous? Is this just playing? This, like, playing at being spacemen and women?
Yeah. I don't want to say it's frivolous, but it's definitely no easy task, right? I mean, SpaceX has announced that they've signed these customers, wealthy customers, for these lunar missions on Starship. But they have to get Starship to orbit first. They have to do a bunch of different missions to prove the hardware, and they have to demonstrate that hardware under NASA's standards. Which is a lot of steps in the process, you know. I don't doubt that they're going to one day get to be able to send private citizens to the moon.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's going to be a tough task, Rick, legally, technologically, et cetera.
Rick, does it make you roll your eyes when people who've got a lot of money say, I want to go to the moon, and they've got no qualifications other than the fact that they just have a lot of money?
You know, there's going to be opportunities for everybody. I think there's an argument to be made for having someone who has a background in the arts to help describe what they're seeing. You know, when we went to the moon in Apollo, we used the NASA astronauts, and giving an opportunity for someone who has a background in writing or in the visual arts to be able to convey what they're seeing in real time and sharing it with the rest of the world. I think there's a lot of good discoveries and some shared experiences that we can all benefit from with that.
I want to just talk about the legal aspects of this, because who owns the moon? Who allows us as explorers, as scientists, to be on the moon? What are the legal ramifications of that? Earlier we spoke to Evie, and Evie brought up a couple of challenges that I'd like you to, first of all, Joey, if you could address. Let's have a listen to Evie.
One of the major ethical challenges we have regarding humanity's exploration of space is the need to protect the environment. That means not contributing to the ever-increasing amount of orbital debris or space junk, and protecting the landscapes that we encounter on other planets. In terms of how we regulate this, we have the Outer Space Treaty, teaching us to share space resources, and also the Interagency Space Debris Coordination Committee, which deals with remediation and mitigation of orbital debris. But we do need more enforceable tools to help everyone work together to be better star citizens.
Joey.
Yeah, it's a really important issue. Space debris is getting worse and worse by the day, and it requires a lot of international cooperation. And There's a working group at the United Nations where countries, including China and the U.S., are pitching their ideas on how to solve this. So there's some progress happening there. But when we get to the moon, there's a lot of other questions. NASA has this legal regime called the Artemis Accords. It's not a treaty in effect, but it is. It sets forth a set of standards for how companies and countries are supposed to behave on the moon. Because think about it, like, we have cultural heritage sites on the moon and we have important assets. What is going to prevent a country from coming by and landing their rocket on that, so to speak? Which, you know, I'm not saying would happen, but, you know, it could. And there's really no real laws that would say, like, you cannot do this, or this is why, you know, that's bad. And so NASA right now is trying to come up with all these different, you know, mechanisms to get other countries on board with safe and sustainable, you know, behavior on the lunar surface.
See, I'm really cynical because we have accords on Earth, and certain countries decide that we're not going to sign up to that accord, including the United States, depending on whether it suits them or doesn't suit them. So Artemis Accords, it looks good, it looks really snazzy, but what difference does that make?
That's a good point, because, I mean, you look at the space powers, the U.S., Russia, and China. The U.S. has courted a lot of its own allies to sign on to the Artemis Accords, but China and Russia are not signatories to the Artemis Accords yet, I don't know if they will be
or
in the future.
Ever,
but
maybe.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, there are people who have a lot of doubts, and China has wanted to take a more United Nations approach instead of multilateral Artemis Accords approach. But so I don't really know how exactly it's going to work out. But the fact is that NASA does need to coordinate with China if both of those countries are going to the moon. There's a lot of, you know, really attractive destinations on the South Pole. And there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, NASA needs to start talking to China in a more collaborative way, because they're largely barred from doing so because of a 2011 law. But I'd like to hear, you know, what other people say about, you know, whether we should cooperate more with China in the future on the moon.
I also have a cynical viewpoint regarding the United Nations' ability to govern anything on Earth or the moon. And I think that maybe a new body needs to be created, a bridge between China, the United States, and Russia, to talk specifically about land ownership and land usage on the moon, sharing of resources, who has the, you know, who has the ability to get, if there's water in a certain area, who has the rights to that water, who has the rights to digging sites. I think that the United Nations leaning on that body for laws and regulations on the moon, or even guidelines, I think that will enable nations to do whatever they want.
So the Artemis Accords are a great first step. And so I'm proud of the forward-thinking approach that NASA's taken to try to write down some of these important questions that need to be answered, and to provide a framework for a peaceful approach to the moon. And as of today, we've got over 20 nations who have already signed on to the Artemis Accords, and it includes nations from all around the world. Even some of the nations who are really trying to start up their own space program, like the United Arab Emirates. And so we're really proud to be partnering with all of those nations, and are hopeful that the upcoming exploration of the moon will retain that peaceful focus.
All right, Rick, help me out with the speed round, if I may. Excuse me, Joey. We've got lots of questions from our audience, and I'm going to get them to speak to Rick, because how often do you have to get to speak to a flight director from NASA? Instant answers, though, Rick, because I don't have all day. So Elisa says, how would we survive without electricity, food, water, and a place to live on the moon? Rick.
We are going to land at the South Pole, which provides an opportunity to have near continuous sunlight and not have to rely on bringing heavy batteries or fuel cells.
Yasmina says, I prefer to go to Mars. And your response, Rick, is what?
Mars is like running a marathon. You can't get off the couch and go run a marathon immediately. So let's start with a smaller step, like the moon, learn how to operate on the moon, and then move on to Mars.
One more question for you, Rick, and this is from Adored Pariah. Safety protocols would be nice. Reasonable taxation, and to require reasonable taxation, this might be a way to actually fund what is an incredibly expensive series of missions to put a permanent base on the moon. Thoughts? How do we pay for this?
The key part is having that international collaboration. No one nation or one company is going to be able to undertake the types of ambitious things that we're doing in Artemis alone. And so we need that coalition of nations and companies to all join together to be successful.
I'm going to share, thank you, Rick, for sharing your knowledge with us. I'm going to share with our audience the sort of steps that we have to go through from where we are right now to where we might be in 2 or 3 years' time. So the plan is a 2025 Artemis 3 mission, the first moon landing since 1972. That's just a couple of years away. SLS Orion spacecraft cost, this is the NASA spacecraft, $40 billion. And then projected Artemis spending is $93 billion. Joey, you know what I'm going to ask you. People will hear that sum of money and just go, what the what? $93 billion.
Yeah. The rocket, the SLS rocket is kind of included in the $93 billion, and it does sound like a lot. It's far more than NASA gets a year from Congress. And when you ask NASA, I think one of their best answers is, well, look at the spin-off technologies that we've created going to space. I mean, investing, you know, billions of dollars in the ISS has created really important medical technologies here on Earth that, you know, you would not think bear any relation to space. And when we're going further to the moon, that's going to create, you know, other technologies that could be of use on Earth as well. I can't name specific examples yet. Maybe Rick can help me out with that. But that's kind of just the bigger argument, is that this investment is not just about sending people to the moon and having fun on the moon just to have fun on the moon. It's about, you know, exploring science, scientific discovery, and also inventing new technologies that can benefit other people on Earth.
Yeah, those sounds like, on the surface, they may sound like high dollar amounts, but NASA gets a tremendous bang for the buck for the U.S. tax dollar. Our budget is just about a half of a penny of every tax dollar. And so if you think about all the other things that the U.S. government is involved in, the amount of return on investment for the NASA budget is really quite tremendous.
I'm just going to bring
in... I also want to say NASA's also...
Really quickly.
I was just going to say NASA's experimenting with more commercial models to bring the cost down of rockets like SLS. It's been very expensive and over budget. And I think they're trying to work more towards a cheaper way to get to space.
I'm just going to bring in Professor Christopher Kokonos, who spoke to us a little bit earlier, just about some of the warnings that we need to be careful about if we are going to be exploring and living on the moon. Let's have a listen. Let's have a look.
It is important that we return to the moon for its scientific potential. And because if we stay and we're thoughtful citizens of the moon, it could help teach us how to solve problems without creating new ones. And for that to happen, we have to love the moon as it is, respect it as a real place. It's a sublime moving landscape. And you look through the telescope and you can see that for yourself. And places that we love and respect, we need to treat well. So that means, I think, on the moon, having enhanced protections for Apollo and other historic sites. It means equitable use of resources. And it means, I think, to have wilderness areas, as we do on planet Earth, that are free of human impact, so we don't plunder the moon.
So that's a professor imagining what life on the moon might look like. The Artemis team have already done that work for us. This is what the Artemis base camp, the animation, looks like. I want to leave you with these pictures because this may well be possible in just a couple of years' time. Rick, are you ready for this? Is this a possibility? Is this going to happen in your lifetime?
Absolutely. This is a great time to be working at NASA, a great time to be a flight director. We are really looking forward to what the next couple of years brings.
All right. Thank you so much to Robin and Joey and Rick, who you can tell are so pumped about the moon. 2025, are we going to be on target, Robin? Yes, no, maybe?
Absolutely not. No, we're not looking at a human landing on the moon for at least 5, 6, maybe even 7 years. That 2024, 2025 time frame.
Yeah.
that time frame is political, and I know we didn't get into it, but
we didn't.
That time frame was set.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, moon lovers, Robin, Joey, Rick, and thank you for your questions. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.